Welcome to the talk show dedicated to the wine industry. It's All About Wine. With your host, winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida State's Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call our guest line at any time during the live show at area code 646-727-3235.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is educate people and make wine less confusing and more friendly.
Broadcasting on blogtalkradio.com from coast to coast.
Basser, Kansas.
Deming, New Mexico.
Ithaca, New York.
Knoxville.
Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Lexington, Kentucky.
Montana.
Moscow, Idaho.
New Hampshire.
New Mexico.
Santa Rosa.
Sevierville, Tennessee.
South Dakota.
The coast of Maine.
The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Westport, Mass.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that. Alba Vineyards.
Blog.10Live.
Boyslip Winery.
Brotherhood.
Gamma's Prairie Winery.
Candia Vineyards.
Fellow de Borgheses.
Eagle Springs Winery.
Flathead Lake Winery.
Free the Grapes.
Grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery.
Hershey Harrisburg Wine Country.
Holy Field Vineyard and Winery.
Tommy Bird Ridge Winery.
Joy Soy of Wine.
Prairie Berry.
Rainborn Wines.
Rocky Top Wine Trail.
Sheila Lauer Vineyards and Winery.
Southwest Wine.
Haber Hill.
Ten Spoon.
University of Kentucky Extension.
Vineyard at Hershey.
Vivac Winery.
Walt Vineyard.
Westport Rivers.
Wine Flower.
And around the world.
TheDriftingWineMaker.com.
DonColtBiz.
I just arrived in Bali about 3 days ago.
All About Wine is on.
If you have any questions or anything to talk about, we will be more than happy to talk to you about or search it for you or try to find information for you out there, because there is a lot of information out there about wine.
We do occasionally get off topic.
Del Boar Winery.
The most well-known haunted winery in the Midwest.
I've heard voices at the winery.
Call area code 646-727-3235 and let's talk about wine on air. And now, wine enthusiast and industry representatives, All About Wine is on. Here is your host, Ron.
Everybody's happy and thrilled and all that to be a bus person down here at the show tonight. Temperature a little bit chilly for us. We're looking, right now in the mid-60s, low 60s, actually. And it's supposed to start cool for the next few days here. I say cool. This is Florida cool. You have to remember that. But cool for the next few days. And we're supposed to get down to almost freezing come Sunday night. And then it gets back warming up again. A week from this Saturday, is it? I believe the 19th, which is, a week from today, the 19th. The pitchers and catchers report for spring training down here in Florida and over in Arizona. So you know it's going to start getting warm eventually. All of you people up there in the cold northeast, under feet and feet of snow, they will be open the ballparks eventually. If all the snow ever melts in the ballpark, that might be one of the places that they're storing that stuff. So who knows? But we have ourselves. Mike's not with us again tonight. I don't know. Mike's job is good for him, but we do miss him. excuse me. But we do have ourselves a great guest tonight. We have a Virginia winery, Barboursville Vineyards in Barboursville, Virginia. A lot of history, a lot of neat stuff for that winery, and we hope our guests will be able to tell us some about it. Luca Peschina is the winemaker of Barboursville Vineyards of Virginia. And, Luca's got himself quite a resume. Originally he was born in Torino, Italy. And he has got himself a degree in oenology in 1983 from Institute Umberto Primo from Alba, Italy. He is a third-generation winemaker currently, and he has been since 1990. So he's quite a few years there. He's been at Barboursville, full responsibility of all the operations there. They have over 840 acres with 180 in vineyard, plus a 50-seat restaurant that they opened in 2013 and produce over 40,000 cases a year. He has traveled and worked everywhere. He's worked for the Christian Brothers Vineyard and Cellars in St. Helena, Napa. He has worked for Winmore Wine Cellar in Naples, New York, in the Finger Lake District. He has also worked with the Luigi Bosca Figli Winery in Canelli, Italy. And he is now the general manager and winemaker of Barbersville. It just, you know, he sent me this list of his stuff. I mean, you know, yay, Luca, you're great. He's vice president of the Virginia Wineries Association. He's been appointed by the board of Virginia, or governor of Virginia, as a board member of the Virginia Wine Board for four different terms under four different governors. And he was named Orange County Business Person of the Year in April 2001. October 2002, he received the Wine Person of the Year Award from the Virginia Wineries Association. And you know, I can go on and on. He has been mentioned in numerous magazines. I won't read them all. CNN, USA Today, Discovery Channel, New York Times, Bon Appetit, San Francisco Chronicle, San Diego Tribune, Wall Street Journal. Also has been in Decanter, Wine Enthusiast, Wine Spectator. The man is well respected and very well known in the communities and stuff. So he will be our guest. And as soon as he calls in, I told him I would call him, and he said he wasn't sure where he would be tonight. So he said that he would call me. So this is something new too, waiting for a phone call from a guest. We usually don't do that because Mike gets a hold of him when we get him on here. So we are now waiting for Luca to call us. And when he does, we will get him on the air and get him started here. But previous to that, I guess we can, I'll tell you what we do. This Sunday, we have a class. So let me go ahead and play this for you.
Hey, this is Mike. Coming up this Sunday at Florida State's Winery from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. is another wine class. That's right. Wine class at Florida State's Winery featuring winemaker, vineyardist, cellar master, and tasting expert Ron Hunt. He shares his experiences and educational knowledge of wine in a detailed 3-hour wine class. It's a lot of fun and a great way to learn something new about wine. Some of the topics that are covered include a brief history of wines, wine grape varietals, wine grape diseases, wine glass styles and uses, cork history, evolution and uses, oak aging, wine tasting and rating wines, and my favorite, of course, the sampling of wines and a discussion. It's a great presentation, and it's located in the Florida State's Winery Tasting Room. For more information and to RSVP, which we would recommend, please contact the winery at area code 813-996-2113. Again, Florida State's Winery is phone number 813-996-2113. Florida State's Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Don't forget wine class this Sunday from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Florida State's Winery. See you there.
All right, we have our guest ready. He did call in like he said he would. Let me bring him right on right now. Hello, Luca, you're on the air. Thank you for joining us tonight. We really do appreciate it.
I'm very pleased that you called me. It's snowing up here. How is down there?
Is it really? Oh, no.
Oh, well.
I thought you guys were going to be missing all that. I thought you were going to be south of it.
Grapes, they like the snow, the vineyard, so.
I just read, some of your information that you sent me. You really got yourself quite a background, quite a history with grapes and vineyards and awards and all sorts of stuff. Congrats on all that.
Well, thank you. Well, I grew up in it, in Italy, and for some reason I had a desire to go somewhere else, and especially in a place where there was no limitation about what to grow, what to blend, and Virginia came about as a very new region, and say, why not? And I left, and I'm here.
Yeah, you've been there, though, since what, 1991?
Yeah, it's going to be 25 years this July, yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a bit of time there in Virginia. Why Barbersville?
Well, I actually in 90, I after working for 8 years for a fairly large wine family, I had a desire to work for a wine family that was very devoted to producing the very fine wines and from the vineyards up. And so I looked for among the top family of vintners in Italy, and the Zunning family is the one that approached me, and we talk, and the name of Virginia came up, and I have really no idea that Virginia was growing any grapes, but nevertheless was very intriguing to go in a whole new wine region which was still to be developed. And I came and I just loved it. I fell in love with the place, with the estate, with the people in Virginia, the climate, the whole thing just fit. And now I got to go back to Italy as a tourist, which is really good.
Yeah, I'm a tourist from Italy. Yeah.
Yeah. I do miss my family a little bit. You know, I have my mother there and two brothers. But, you know, I get to see them a few times a year. They come to visit, and I have a new family here, meaning, you know, my wife and my three kids. So life is good. Life is good.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, there's lots of questions I have for you now.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start throwing out things and, you know, take as long as you want to answer each one. But I was really fascinated. Barbersville Vineyards, I read a little bit of the heritage. That is right near the same area that Thomas Jefferson had his estate and vineyard, right?
Yes, not far south from us, 20 some miles, is Monticello, the estate that belonged to Thomas Jefferson. And on that site, he did 7 different specific attempts, very well recorded, to grow European grapes. Late 1700 and the last in 1807, they all failed to produce wine, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a big gap from that to 1970s when this Italian family is reintroducing European grapes, and that when it comes in place, the estate of Barbersville.
Wow.
So there are more ties to Jefferson. Governor James Barber was the owner of this estate. Jefferson designed a beautiful home for him on the estate, although Barber here never planted any grapes.
Oh.
So grapes come to Barbersville only in 1976. Before that was mainly Merino's sheep farm.
Uh-huh. So the family that started the vineyard there and started the winemaking there is an Italian family also.
It is. It is. The name is Zonin, Z-O-N-I-N, and they are from Veneto. And actually they have several estates throughout Italy where they do grow several thousand acres of vineyards.
Uh-oh.
And they produce a lot of wines. And it's actually the largest privately held by the family, basically, a vineyard in Italy. So, under many different estates, the main brand is Zunning. Yeah.
Wow, that I never realized that. So, do they spend their time there, or do they just let you take care of it?
They mainly spend the time in Italy, since they have a lot of estates to follow there. But between the founder, Gianni, and the sons, also they come frequently here, although they do spend most of the time in Italy.
Uh-huh. The grapes that you have there now, this is something I always like to talk to people. And you're the first Virginia winemaker. And while I'm thinking of this, If you have any friends or anybody that has wineries there in Virginia that you're friends with, tell them I'd like to get them on the program. I mean, it's just, it's a good way to promote wineries
sure.
in Virginia and everything else. So, you know, have them email me and I will be happy to get them scheduled because Virginia.
There are a lot of great stories of people that are in, it's 270 wineries now, and
wow.
among all of them, there are some great stories about how people started and why. And it's a very good core group that's really, really focused on quality. Quality is number one aim that we have. It's not just make wine and to please people and get the tourists in and out of the door. It really is, we're aimed at quality. We're being very specific on the microclimates that we have in Virginia. I mean, we go from the seashore to few feet above sea level to the Shenandoah Valley up at 2,000 feet, some vineyards. So it's very diverse.
Wow. Yes, it is. Well, I'm just, if you know anyone or if you contact them, tell them to email me. You've got my All About Wine email address. And I would love, because I've been trying to get a hold of people. And I call and it's winter hours and I'm having a heck of a time getting a hold of people. So just as an aside here, just tell them to get a hold of me and we'll get them scheduled at their convenience. But vineyards, what do you have planted? What grapes are you growing there?
Well, in the 70s, it was more the international varieties like Chardonnay, Riesling, Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, and so on. Throughout the years, the focus went toward in the whites, definitely Viognier. We are now also, in the past few years, finding great results and consistency in Vermentino, which is a grape typical from Sardinia.
Oh.
And in the reds, we are, for our site and our soil type, we have incredible consistency in quality in Merlot, Cabernet Franc, and also an Italian variety, Nebbiolo.
Oh,
not that other varieties don't do well, but with a little less consistency, like Petit Verdot, perhaps the last Cabernet Sauvignon, which normally in clay has a bit more difficulty to produce very high quality. But we also have some very high peaks on Cabernet, especially in a very, very dry year, which we get 2 years out of 10. That really is the core of the wines. And then we have other varieties that we grow in smaller acreage.
So these are the ones you usually come out with the varietals on, or do you do a lot of blending?
We do. We do have varietals, and then we do have a blend specifically, it's called Octagon, which we produce only in what we consider a fine vintage. And that is always predominantly a blend of Merlot and Cabernet Franc, with also Petit Verdot and Cabernet Sauvignon within the blend.
Oh, wow.
But the core, at least around 75%, is always between Merlot and Cabernet Franc. Those are really the what we can always count on in those vintages, and then the rest is blended. So in other times we do blend, but in smaller percentages, like in the Cabernet Franc, frequently we have small percentages of Petit Verdot. And like the Nebbiolo. Nebbiolo in Italian grape is always pure Nebbiolo because it really it doesn't need, or let's say when you blend things in Nebbiolo, you tend to take away the classic signature of a grape that is very definite. It doesn't blend as well, let's put it that way. It just likes to be left alone.
I enjoy a good Nebbiolo. I
thank you.
That is always. In fact, you've got some here. I'm looking at your wine. You've got some here that I really I find fascinating. Do you grow all these to an extent? I'm looking at the wines right now. Are all of these part of the of your vineyard there, or do you get some grapes shipped
in? No, they are not. The one variety that we do not produce sufficient volume is Chardonnay. And therefore, last year we had three growers in Virginia that help us supplying enough Chardonnay for the demand. We sell a very large amount of Chardonnay in the state of Virginia. None of it goes outside Virginia. So for that, we have to get from other growers. That also help us using the acreage we have on grapes that are a bit more specific, like the Nebbiolo, like Vermentino. There are very few people growing it.
Yeah.
And so we don't have unlimited land here on the estate, even though we have 900 acres. It's only about 200 that are really top quality soils and slopes for producing quality grapes. So we're getting close to use all the land we have, and therefore having a little bit of relationship with other growers makes it a bit more viable for us to get some supply from other districts.
Which your comments there just led me to other questions. Number one, I am finding, as I talk to wineries around the country, that the states are having problems finding enough grapes within that state to still keep it that state. Virginia, is there enough vineyards in the state to keep up? I mean, 270 wineries. I mean, that's...
There is a... What's happening now is that there is a lot of growth of tourism, and the demand is growing. And actually, what's growing is the amount of independent growers.
Oh,
there are
good.
Several hundred growers now. They don't vinify, they don't produce wine, but have somewhat understood that they have some land that. Is idle, basically. There's a lot of idle land in Virginia. It's pasture or just grazed by horses. And so there's a lot of independent vineyards. They are very well studied, the people. They really do a research of the sites. There are great seminars going on. So that's taking off. Let's say it may take a few years to catch up. In fact, the prices of some grapes are going quite high. Especially if they're quality grapes. So the things are looking good. It's always good when there is demand for grapes, demand for wine, and people that want to invest and grow for quality. And that's happening in Virginia. We're still very small compared to California. Don't get me wrong. We'll never catch up, and that's not the point to catch up with. The point is to establish a reputation for quality. That's what I think in the long term is going to be a good payback for us.
You know, that's what happened, though, in California a number of years ago. I remember when I lived out there, Napa had a lot of growers and very few wineries. And all these growers says, hey, why don't I just go ahead and make wine and open up a winery?
Absolutely.
That going to be an issue there in Virginia as all these growers start saying, hey, this is a great market. Maybe I should switch over to just open up a winery.
Some of them are doing that exact thing. Some others, actually, they open a winery and then they prefer not to plant because it's a big investment. It takes 3 years for the grapes to come back into the winery. You know, you plant your vines, you spend $30,000-$40,000 an acre, and then you just sit there and keep working and get nothing from it.
Watch it grow.
So it's easier to go buy some grapes, right? But the grapes are now, if they're not there, then people are figuring out, hey, you know what, it's time to reinvest. It's really, if you start a winery and you want to start from the ground up, it's something you have to think 10 years ahead.
Right.
Otherwise, don't get into it because it can be very, very frustrating.
Without a doubt. And that's just it, though. I mean, you know, once they open up and start doing the vineyards there, and as they produce, that gives them the motivation to go ahead and, hey, I've got the grapes now, and I've went through that. It's time to open up a winery.
Exactly. So no, it's good. It's very good.
Yeah, and that's everywhere. I think, I was talking to wineries in Texas, and they said, we need growers here. If anybody in the world wants to grow grapes, come to Texas. And I hear that everywhere. And, everyone wants grapes, and because they are at a premium, it seems.
It is. And the great thing in America, I've been, in 25 years, I've seen a change, the way people approach wine, they know wine. It's incredible how more demanding and appreciative are for when you produce a great bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And that's creating a whole different approach from the grower side also, how to grow the grapes. It's not anymore a commodity where people just try to grow as much grapes as they can without thinking, well, what's the wine going to taste like? So it's very nice. I really enjoy being part of this growth of the culture of wine in America. It's fascinating.
And you're absolutely right on that too. I have to reiterate on what you were saying there, that the growers are taking more time. They are actually taking pride in it and finding that they don't have to just crank out wine and sell the grapes. If they have good grapes, and it really benefits everyone, including themselves, because they can demand a higher price, obviously. So,
yes. And if you compare it to other type of crops that are actually not appreciated for the quality, a lot of crops are still very much tied to world market and production worldwide, or whatever it is, corn, soybeans, whatever. I'm just expanding it. To where it's you're more in an area where maybe there is money, but there is a bit more reward, I think, when you do a product like grapes and wine. I mean, I'm not trying to talk anybody now. I'm just kind of, you gotta like it. Anyway.
Exactly. The soil, that's another thing you mentioned too. What type of soils do you have there? What is the,
where are we in your area?
Yeah,
where we are basically are the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, which are actually geologically the oldest in North America, and that's why they're fairly high, but they're very soft, they're very gentle because they broke down so much. And so at the foothills, there's sedimentation of all of this the degradation of the mountains. And they formed a lot of areas with this red clay, and it's very, very red. It's just gorgeous to see. It's a medium to medium rich soil, and that's where it comes into play. Merlot, which is a weak growing plant, that it needs a soil that is a bit richer. Versus Cabernet Sauvignon is a very vigorously feeding plant. And if you put it on an environment where there is more food, risk is the plant grows too fast, grows too vigorous, and it produces lots of leaves but doesn't concentrate effort into growing the great fruit. Mm. So, and this soil you find in a lot of the Piedmont of Virginia. So it's a fairly big area. And then you have the issue of the slope. You slope one direction or the other direction, so some soils are more hot, some are cooler, and so the variation are many. But it's a beautiful soil, and it's found also in other regions, of Italy and Australia, and so it's not completely out of the range of soils you find around the world.
The weather, you just said it was snowing. What is your winter highs and lows, your summer highs and lows? Also, while we're on this, when do you get bud break and when do you harvest?
Yeah, basically, I like to give you one description before I start. We are the latitude of Sicily, basically. So let's start from there. So when the sun is out in the summer, it's intense. The radiation are intense. Most winters here tend to be fairly cold, but not extreme. So we may get some time in the single digits, but not every winter for sure. Grapevines, they tolerate well cold weather all the way down to zero or just about below zero. Cold winter kills a lot of bugs, which is good. A lot of insects actually are a problem in vineyards. So having a cold winter cleans a little bit the insect population, especially those that were imported by other areas in the past two or three decades that don't have nothing to do here. Spring, like stink bugs.
Yes.
or so. And then the spring, on average, the spring is fairly wet, which we need that rain for the start of the season. Bud break, we have always around the first week in April. And then the spring continues on average to be fairly good amount of water, which we really need. When it comes to summer, it can be, Virginia can be from very dry to very wet. To give you an idea, we have, on average, I've seen 2 to 3 vintages very dry, and another 2, but no more than 2, fairly wet, and then the other are in between where the rainfall actually is needed because we do not have irrigation systems. We do have an emergency irrigation in place, which we bring water to the vineyards if needed, and it's only on those very dry years. What really makes or break the vintage, it's the period from the second, third week of August to early October. That's when the grapes are getting softer, the berries are getting soft, the sugar content is increasing, and that's where the aromas, the flavor, the texture of the grape itself is formed. So it's not as relevant to have a perfect season, let's say the right amount of sun and rain all the way through August. What's the problem is what's going to happen from that mid-August, late August through October is the issue. Like 2011, we had a beautiful season all the way to September 3rd, and then we had about 4 weeks of rain just about every day.
Ooh.
It was one of the most challenging vintages we had. On the other hand, last year, 2014, it was a bit too wet to mid-August, and then we had about 6 weeks of straight high-pressure system, nice temperature, intense sunshine, and the vintage was spectacular. But if you have asked somebody that is not very much a season grower, in 2011, early September, they would have told you, oh, this is the best vintage ever. And, I mean, we would have speak too early. Or last year, if you ask in mid-August, when there was still some rain, people, it's still difficult. We have to pull, cut the grass, pull the weeds, and edge the vines. It would be more like a complaint vintage. But then a few days later, just everything turned around. It was spectacular. So that's how Virginia is. It's a bit more unpredictable, and that's just about the same you find when you go to Europe, in Italy, in France. Where I'm from, in Piemonte, the same thing. We have the dry year, the wet year, in between. So it's very continental, the weather. Yeah.
Oh, that's probably why there's 270 wineries in Virginia, too, because
absolutely.
Of that reason. Yeah. Okay, we're out of the vineyard. We're going into the cellar. Do you use oak or stainless steel or plastic, or what is your...
For our white wine winemaking, we prefer to go strictly stainless steel. I like to retain the fragrance and the aromatics of whites, and retain freshness. That's our goal, and therefore we have seen that using stainless steel, which does not impart any characteristic to the wine in a way of aromas, and it keeps the wine more sheltered from oxidation. We chose that style. For reds, it's very different. Red wines, they do require a barrel aging, in my opinion. A red wine, when it's young, it's more rustic in a way, more aggressive. And it needs the period of softening and ripening that the barrel contributes through allowing oxygen slowly and gently permeate and go into the wine and cause the maturation of wine. The other thing the barrel also does it bring in, it can be a little bit of the aromatics, because some of them are toasted and charred, and so they do impart an aromatic from the wood toasting. And then the story can be long about what kind of toasting, old oak, French oak, American oak. We can go on for hours. But basically,
right.
In the reds, in all the reds, they do go through a period of élevage or mature through the wood from minimum 6 months up to 14, 15 months.
Mm.
And it varies with the vintage and the type of wine and what have you. So,
you mentioned all the different types. So could you primarily use French, American?
As much as I believe in sourcing any product, any supplies from the U.S., because since I'm here also, I still do prefer the quality of the French oak for our reds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very important choosing a cooper. A cooper is a craft that is incredible. You can give the same cooper the same logs for making barrels, and they can make a good barrel or an excellent barrel. And so we start a relationship with one cooper. Actually, they are in Italy. They are in the north of Italy. They go in France. They buy the logs from France. They ship them to Italy. And if I have a great harvest, like we had this year in early October, I call Mauro Gamba down in Italy and say, Mauro, great vintage. I need 70, 80, 100 barrels. and he's happy.
He goes, wow, that many.
and some years I have to call Mauro and say, Mauro, I'm so sorry, but like in 2011, say, Mauro, the vintage is not that great. It's a good vintage. I will need no barrels. And by using one cooper, I establish a relationship, and I know they really will send me the best barrel they have, and they will carve them, produce them to the best specification that we need. So
that's exciting too. When you know that you don't have to worry about that. That is an exciting thing to know that you're comfortable.
It is.
And all that. Yeah. So that's great. So. Your reserves then obviously are longer oak than your non-reserve?
Yes. On average, what we label as a reserve, it spends a little more time in the wood because it will start as a young wine with a bit more, they're going to be more concentrated, therefore more aggressive, and they will take longer time of seasoning and maturing in the wood to soften. And so they'll take longer.
Yeah, right. Now, we have it in the bottles. I'm going to talk about your wines. You explained the octagon. And I don't want deep explanation on all these because I know as a winemaker you are in love with your wines and you can talk to us about them like they are your child.
Sure.
Your Pinot Grigio, is that a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Pinot Grigio, it's a variety that I planted in 91 when I came, the year after I came. And still is a very important variety for us because it ripens very early in the season, about mid-August, late August. Let's say by the 25th of August is ripe. So it's a grape that ripening earlier brings in the beginning of the season. It produces a very fragrant, refreshing wine that we sell very promptly early into the following year. It's priced at a very good entry level price, around $15. And people know the variety. They know the variety. They want it. And compared to a lot of other Pinot Grigio, that I have to say, they don't have a whole lot of character and taste. Ours has a good, very good, refreshing, rich aftertaste.
Oh.
And is very popular, very, very popular. It's
Pinot Grigios.
Yeah.
Oh, I just want to say Pinot Grigios are very popular now anyway, so it's good
Absolutely.
To hear that this one has a little bit more depth to it. I mean, a lot of Pinot Grigios, like you say, don't give you that aftertaste.
No.
It's just there. Yeah.
And in that case, I have to say, it's all tied to the yield. If you yield very high, you fertilize and you irrigate, you can push the vineyard to produce higher yields. But the grapes, they will have a less intense taste, and it will transfer, everything transferred all the way to the bottle. So the wine will be, you know, drinkable, quaffable, pleasing, but will not have that longer, more intense taste.
And then that's really what you should be looking for. You talked already about your Chardonnay that you're sourcing that in, but Sauvignon Blanc, is that one of yours also, or is that sourced?
Yes, Sauvignon Blanc, it's a project that actually started here in 1984.
Wow.
There was a vineyard planted in 84. I found it in 90. And for many years we had from very good to, I have to say, almost to mediocre results according to the vintages. And so a few years ago, we decided either we pull the vineyard out because of this inconsistency, or we say, well, let's try. Let's give one more try. And so we did plant a six-acre new block with all new plant material, meaning we sourced the Sauvignon Blanc plants from new clones, new subspecies, we call them, of Sauvignon Blanc. They're called clones.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredible. The increase in quality on Sauvignon Blanc we have seen in the past the past 5 years. And so we developed a Sauvignon Blanc reserve, which we only sell here at the vineyards.
Oh.
And it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. I would have never thought that by really switching the whole plant material, restarting, would have brought us such results. Still, it's a small production, which we only have here on the estate at the vineyard, but that's another discovery.
That's, you know, and that you've said something there that is really, I discovered talking to wineries in Oregon, and the Pinot Noir in Oregon is really clones, and that's about all they use. And you just reaffirm
yes.
the fact that clones really are giving a better quality overall.
Absolutely.
Than, you know, it's just okay. it's
Look,
amazing.
When Barbeville started in 1976, Chardonnay was only available in one denomination, which was actually sold from nursery as Pinot Chardonnay. I still have all the invoices calling it Pinot Chardonnay. There was not yet even the concept of clone in the 70s. So when you think this vineyard started in 76, with that limitation, and we work with those grapes all the way into the 90s, and now in the 90s we pulled everything up and we start replanting with all the new clones.
Oh.
So, yeah.
So the quality jump. Now, the Vermentino. I have to admit, I'm not familiar with that grape. Tell me about that wine and that grape.
It's a grape that really you find the best example of it in, like, Sardinia, Sicily, in Liguria. Uh-huh. It's a grape that really likes to be sun hit by the warm sun of the summer. And here in Virginia, we do get fairly intense, if not very intense, sun in the summer. And I say, why not? Let's plant some. We plant a fairly small amount, and we produced the first vintage in 2010, very dry, hot year, and then the following 11 was quite a bit more wet, and produced a great wine. in both vintages. Different characteristic, but great wines. So we say, great. If it does well in a very dry and in a very wet year, I think we have something going here. So we put a lot more acres. Very fragrant. It almost has some hints of lemon and sage, and it's almost slightly salty in the taste. Very, very, very makes you salivate when you drink it, and you know it's just makes you want to eat. So that's
you're pairing this with what on the table?
Oh my gosh, I had a dinner a week ago with some friends, and I don't know what if you know what Botarga is. It's a sea mullet, dried eggs. It's typical from Sardinia, and then you just grate the eggs on a pasta with some chopped garlic and some parsley. It's phenomenal. Or you can just have it with smoked salmon or with grilled seafood. It's a seafood wine, but no question.
Not familiar with it at all. That sounds exciting, though.
It's not uncommon in the U.S. in some delis. Some delis have it. Botarga, Bottarga. Try it. It's phenomenal.
Okay, Bottarga. Okay, that is Vermentino then.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. All right, I will have to look for that. And then Viognier, the style
Viognier is a variety that was introduced in the early 90s in Virginia by Horton Vineyards, which are our neighbors here in the village, typical from the south of France. And again, Viognier showed that in our climate produces very fragrant, very, very fragrant wine, almost floral, intense floral, and almost like in some year where it's warmer, almost like tropical fruit, passion fruit. It's definitely can be a fairly luscious white, and we like to pick it a little earlier than when it gets too ripe or very ripe to retain a bit more refreshing characters like a pear or apple. And then still we have a lot of aromatics behind that. And pairing with that, to me, one of the best is just very simply grilled shrimp with nothing on it. Just grill the shrimp and let them be sweet. And the wine kicks in perfectly.
That sounds fantastic. You're making me hungry. Your reds, the Merlots, that is also your vineyard, I assume.
Yes.
And
Merlot, for example, we have four different vineyards of Merlot.
Oh.
Two actually are cultivated to produce what we describe as an entry level wine in price and also in intensity. So we yield a little higher in these two vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have two other vineyards where we yield much lower. They also are two vineyards with a better exposure, better sight. The soil is better just to produce a great Merlot. And so those two other vineyards we cultivate with in a way to produce the finest Merlot we can. And that will go then in our octagon.
Mm.
If we have a vintage where, like 2011, 2003, or 2000, where also those specific sites did not produce the quality we were hoping for, we will declassify those into our lower tier classic Merlot. So it gives us an option to variate and still use the grapes.
Your Merlot Reserve, is that very heavy, a lot of tannins? Does it need age, or is it?
It we don't make it frequently. We made it in 2008, 10, and we will do it in 13. And I would say is a step in between our Merlot that goes in Octagon and our classic Merlot. '10 was such an incredible vintage that we had a lot of fun tasting the wine and deciding where to position them. And that's where we say, you know, I think we have enough of the, from this vineyard to also declare a label of a reserve Merlot, which was a small production. And then the third tier was our Merlot, our classic Merlot. So it went from Merlot Classic, Merlot Reserve, and then Octagon.
A good Merlot. People stay away from Merlot because I think everybody makes it and they're so used to it being big and heavy and
sure.
bold, and you don't have to have it that way. So
no, absolutely. Cabernet Sauvignon, I would say, is a very similar concept of what I just went through with the Merlot, with a little more inconsistency through the vintages to be capable of producing our reserve Cabernet Sauvignon because of the soil adaptation of Cabernet Sauvignon into soil. So with good frequency, with most frequency, we produce a very good, very elegant, but not as structured Cabernet Sauvignon. That's more a signature of the Cabernet here. Then some vintages that are very dry, the wine not only retains its elegance, but it gains power, intensity. So they're more aggressive, which actually I think what's beautiful about Cabernet is to be able to make a big, bold red with a bit of aggressiveness, but then a smooth finish in the back. And so 2 to 3 years out of 10, we can gain that designation of reserve. Other years, we just stay within the classic designation.
And I noticed the reserve here, which is sold out, the 2010.
Yes.
You're
suggesting
the
2010 was a blockbuster. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, 20 years.
It went so fast.
That's almost unheard of when you think Virginia Cabernet 20 years cellar life.
There was a tasting in Texas, a little over 100 Cabernet, mainly from the West Coast, and we were into the blind tasting. We scored the number 13.
Wow.
Surrounded by Napa front and back at way below the price of what was all around us. That's an indication on how some of Virginia wine would do in a comparative tasting with the people not knowing where the wine is from.
And that's the key to it, too. If, you know, the people get this prejudice, I think, when they see the label.
It's normal. We all do. We all do.
Yeah,
we do that with football a lot, I think, right, in America?
Yeah. and one of my favorites, absolutely,
yeah.
I am in love with the Barbera.
Yes.
Great. When I lived in California many, many years ago, they were making a Barbera in California that I fell in love with it. Yes. And I fell in love with that. And it seems that California's gotten away from making the Barbera now for some reason.
Yeah, it's too bad. The reason why Barbera was there, because a lot of Italian immigrants brought it from Piemonte, where I'm from. The village of Asti, which is way north in Napa.
Right.
But Asti is the name of a village where just about where I come from. It's a grape that is a generous. It produces a generous yield, has a good color, not very, very little tannin, and good acidity. So it's refreshing, luscious, rewarding, produces lots of grapes. And so was very popular in the 1900s because of that. And then the Merlot came in, and then the Cab came in and produced wine a little bit more with a little bit more of that strength. And kind of went away, Barbera, unfortunately, I have to say. What we produce here is simply because when I came in 1990, I just had to grow some. And I have to say that I wish it would grow better. It grows well, the grape, but because of has a thin skin, mm-hmm. and the berries they get quite big. If there is excess rainfall, they burst, and then you have to pick. You have to pick. Sometimes you have to pick a little too early from the what uh-huh. would be an ideal. So we have a small production, but it can go from excellent to good or almost good, I have to say. Some years, like 2000 was very tough with Barbera. I would plant more if you had more consistency, but when is the right vintage, oh my gosh, it's good. So.
And that's, I love a Barbera. Always been one of my favorites. Always, always.
Yeah.
Sangiovese, is that another one from home?
Sangiovese, another one from home, introduced in 94, exploring other areas. And unfortunately, we're in the same area of Barbera. We go, it's a bit deep, peaks and valleys, We had a dinner this fall, a very nice dinner. We poured the 1997 vintage Sangiovese. Was spectacular. That was a great year, 01, 02. But then you go 2003 and 04. It was a good wine, but it wasn't a great wine. So again, small acreage, mainly sold here at the vineyard.
And another one of my top two or three is Cabernet Franc.
Great wine. Franc is a whole different story. It's really extremely reliable for us, even in a difficult year. That it may be raining in September, it doesn't deteriorate nearly as it does Barbera or Sangiovese. Very rugged grape, nice deep color, softer tannins, lower natural acidity, so the wine is rounder, great aromatics. In very dry vintages or drier vintages where it's more intense, it can age very well for long-term aging. Or if it's a vintage that is not considered a great vintage, the wine still is very fragrant. It may not age more than 6-7 years, but in those first years, just a beautiful wine and easy to grow.
Go ahead. No, I'm just saying, you say easy to grow, and I'm surprised that more people don't grow it. But when you say Cabernet, people immediately go Sauvignon as opposed to Franc.
Yeah. Look, we are at least 100, and I would say between 100 and 150 for sure, wineries in Virginia at this point that produce Cabernet Franc and hundreds of growers. Because of its consistency and reliability. There is also going on a lot of planting of Cabernet Franc worldwide. People are really realizing that it is a grape that is being overlooked for its characteristics from Italy to Napa. They're planting it everywhere, more of it. So it's.
I love a Cabernet Franc. I really do. It's always been one of my favorites. Your Petit Verdot, is that a lighter, fruitier style, and is that one of yours?
Petit Verdot, it's also all produced here. It enters predominantly in blending. Very, very, very dark wine, fairly aggressive. A bit more narrow profile in a way of aromas. It's not as broad and complex as Cabernet Franc is, at least what we produce here. But it brings in a lot of texture, color, depth, richness when you blend it. And occasionally, some years when we have a little more that we can spare, we do a small bottling of just about pure Petit Verdot. And from what I noticed is that right now what drinks really well is 2008 vintage. It takes six, 7 years to really bloom and become a great wine. So I tell people, I'm sorry, you buy now and hold on. So,
when you suggest 18 years cellar life, that seems, you know, like a long time for a petite Bordeaux.
I know.
I mean,
I know.
Yeah, that's so you do make it bold, obviously.
We do. It's how it grows here, and that's what it produces, is this very, very dark, rich, almost impenetrable red. And it's not that it's not good when it's younger, but I don't find it as elegant, as intriguing as it is a Cabernet Franc at the same age or our blend. So I'm not just, I never look just for power on red wine. I want more. I want elegance. Complexity, richness, but not just that one dimension of just impact.
You don't want one to walk across the room and pour itself in your glass. You want it to sit down and talk with you for a while. Nebbiolo.
Nebbiolo is again my desire of my coming from Piemonte to plant it, and I plant some in 95, just only about an acre. And the first vintage was 98, and then a few other great vintages followed, and we really took notice that the wine was just different in style than what was produced when I was where I'm from. But nevertheless, was a very elegant, beautiful wine. And so we plant more of it. Again, similar story of something that works, and we have to believe to continue on and plant it. For many years, it was not as popular because it's not a very popular grape, Nebbiolo, in America, even though Barolo and Barbaresco produced from it are. But people don't know what Nebbiolo is, and it you know, that is a detriment, maybe, to be able to sell it. But after believing in it and telling people about it and cultivating many followers, now we're actually planting more this coming spring because it's showing great ageability and great characters. And again, similar scenario in Texas, a Texas Somme. I don't know if you heard about it, the event. A lot of sommeliers are there, and they blind tasted several hundred people, and they had a Nebbiolo from Virginia and a Barolo from Piemonte, and the majority of people chose the Nebbiolo from Virginia. comparable price and vintage. And so to me, those are great scenarios where, you know, it says yes, it works. It's
I noticed
more typical Nebbiolo.
I noticed you use it for blending a lot, too.
Nebbiolo?
Yes.
A little bit. Very little. I blend a little bit of Nebbiolo in Petit Verdot. And in a couple of occasions, I blend a little bit of Nebbiolo with Octagon in the late 90s. A very small amount. But otherwise, it's pure. It stays pure. Yeah.
Your rosé, I have to say, it looks like a very dry style rosé, just looking at the residual sugar you have listed here.
Rosé, it's I had to make some in 2005. I was just going to drink it so bad. I would just make some rosé, I tell you. So, you know, I say, well, let's make a rosé. It's interesting because this vineyard was producing rosé in the early 80s as a dry rosé. And it was a total failure, because nobody would drink dry rosé. But, you know, so it took from the early 80s to 2005 to redo a rosé. It's something that it's for people that enjoy it is a great glass of wine, and actually it really is, has some pedigree of a red and some of the white, the refreshing of the white and a little bit of the structure of the red, because we keep it on the skin for quite several hours to get some, a little bit of tannin also.
Mm.
And so I wish it was more popular in a way than it is, but there's a lot of rosés out there and people, you know.
People think sweet. When they start thinking of rosés, they think sweet.
They
are blushes or all that. And that's what I say. Yours is a drier, just going by your residual sugar, but yours is a drier style.
It is dry. It's definitely dry. It is. And so
I think people aren't used to that because they say, oh, that should be sweet, you know. And
right. So it's a
matter of an education, yes. Your sparkling wines. I notice you make a couple of sparkling wines.
It's an interesting project because we did sparkling in the 90s all the way to 2011. And then actually we stopped making them.
Oh.
Those two wines are the only two wines which we do not make here on the estate.
Oh,
and
where did they come from?
It explains about the where they're made. They're made from our sister vineyard in northwest of Italy. It's 100% Pinot Noir, bottle fermented, and we import it with our label saying produced by our estate in Italy under specification from us and so on. I gave away from the sparkling wine 3 years ago because it really is a bit too warm here, the climate, to make sparkling.
Mm.
They prefer a cooler region, cooler district. And so I chose to interrupt the production and use our acreage to devote more toward the other varieties that we spoke, like the Merlot, the Nebbiolo, the Vermentino. So,
and sparkling wine. It's such a pain anyway.
There's also an economical aspect, yes. It's really more costly, more labor intense.
Oh, yes.
And so that was one thing that we did it, and then, you know, you have to move on sometime and just focus on what works.
Yeah. Your dessert wines.
Talking about the label of love, definitely we make two sweet wines, mainly from Moscato.
Oh.
Which is, to me, is the king of the grape for making a sweet wine, and definitely the aromatics of Moscato are phenomenal. But what we do blend with some Vidal.
Uh-huh.
Moscato here, it becomes very fragrant, but it lacks acidity. It's not as refreshing.
Oh.
And so blending Vidal brings in a lot of tartness. And so it balances the sweet and the tart. And we do it in two ways. Some, actually, we pick the grapes, we press them, we blend them, we ferment them. And then when it gets about 8.5%, 9 alcohol, we cool the tank to stop the fermentation, leaving sweetness. And then we filter it and bottle it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fileo. Then we do a passito, which is basically very labor-intense, the most labor-intense wine we make here, actually. All the grapes are picked in the vineyard into small crates, about 15 pounds each. Then they're stacked, and we bring them in a barn right in front of my office. And then we stack them in this barn, and we have big fans, we just move air. For some time, we go over 100 days of very slow dehydration. And the grapes, they just shrivel. They shrivel. They become almost like raisins.
Yeah.
At that point, we press them, and the juice reluctantly flows. It's so thick. It's about 42% sugar at that point. Yes. Then the juice goes in old barrels and sits there for 2 years, slowly ferments, stops, restarts fermentation, and so on. So when it gets between, it stops between 13 and 15% alcohol, yet leaving a lot of sweetness behind. And at that point, then after 2 years, it's ready to be bottled. It's a very ancient method of winemaking, very simple in a way, but very labor-intense. And it produces some very opulent, rich, beautiful wine that I love to pair with blue cheese. It's just phenomenal.
So, it sounds
but
phenomenal.
On that wine, we don't make any money, I think, on making the wine. It's just, I mean, really. But
you just make it so you can have a blue cheese.
We do, you know, we do 4,000 or 5,000 bottles a year. We're winning awards all over the world, all over the world. It's just a classic. It's a classic example of how a great dessert wine can be. It's just beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
So and we do a lot of things, as you see. We do a lot of things, but I have great vineyard manager and great winemaker. Where you know we all love it. So that's how we can do so many things. Otherwise, it would be impossible without it. You know?
We need to talk a little bit, too, about your restaurant and your inn.
Yeah. In the mid-90s, I started organizing some food and wine events here at the vineyard because I realized that really, to really enjoy wine, you need to eat. You need to eat. You need to be
yes.
At the table. You need to be in the environment that makes you want to have some fun or nevertheless pay some attention to what you're drinking, not just gulping it down. And so I did some food and wine events and invite some chefs, and they were very well attended. People really appreciate and understand more why we were making wine. And so in the late 90s, I started thinking, you know, I think we could open a restaurant in this place, and we did. And it's a lot of work to open a restaurant, it really is. And it turned out actually to be way more successful than we thought we could have ever done.
Oh, yeah.
And we hire a great chef, Melissa Close, which unfortunately she's departing us March 1st.
Oh.
But we have her sous chef that has been with us for 5.5 years taking her position. And so it's been a great success, and really it's the best way for us to show people this is how you drink our wine, this is how you can fully understand our wine. And the inn followed a few years later because in the state we have actually three historic homes that were used part-time, you know, when people were visiting or the owner or his children were coming to visit that are grown up, of course, now. And so the owner had a desire to open the door to the public and say, you know what, I don't use this place enough. And so we did quite a bit of more, some renovation and things. But they're building from the late 1700s, early 1800s, very historically decorated and right by a home designed by Thomas Jefferson for James Barber, which is the ruins. And so this has become now what we call an estate of wine. So it's not just wine; it's an estate that is all about, you know, the place altogether:
yeah.
The food, the wine, the accommodations. And so it's only 9 rooms. The whole between 4 buildings, they're very historic, beautiful, great views, of course, the Blue Ridge Mountain. From here, in 30 minutes from the winery, you're on top of the Blue Ridge Parkway with thousands of miles of hikes, and you know, then all the historic sites around here. So it's a special place.
It looks gorgeous. I'm looking at some of the pictures here, and it is just absolutely breathtaking. So
yeah.
It's just fantastic. A couple other things. Number one, the state of Florida government, state of Virginia government, they helpful, they hindrance, you love them, you hate them, want to kill them, want to kiss them?
Well, no, I have to say that at the beginning, I heard they were a bit difficult. because, you know, you have to think in the late 70s, the main, you know, one of the main focus of Virginia, it was tobacco, still is, but in a way of agriculture, there was a lot of tobacco grown. So for a winery, I mean, a family from Italy to open a winery, it was very unusual, let's put it that way. So at the beginning, you know, they were not opposing it. They were just cold about it, you know. It was not a priority. But I have to say that starting in the early 80s already, you start seeing a lot of interest because more wineries are opening, and quickly they realize, you know, great, this is something that actually we could explore and develop, and today it's phenomenal what's going on with the state Department of Agriculture. There's very supportive. We do pay taxes on excise per case.
Right.
It's $3.60 a case of Virginia wine. It's paid.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Most of the country is right around that price. I was talking to Utah, a winery in Utah.
Yeah.
And their excise tax per case is $17 plus, $17.40, something like that. I know. That was my reaction, too.
Thomas Jefferson said one time in his writing, say, that a country where wine is cheap, people are not drunk. But I guess he exaggerated. But basically, sometimes it's the opposite effect when you make things forbidden, you know. Well, I don't know. That's what it is. The problem is that when a state designed their formula to create their income to pay whatever are their bills, they have to choose something. Utah chose that, and it's too bad because now there are some wineries in Utah that are having a hard time.
They're suffering
off.
For it.
Yeah.
They really are.
Virginia, I have to say, being very good, we pay $3.60 per case. The consumer do also when they buy wine. It's included in there. But all of it comes back into promoting education, research, and marketing for winemaking and grape growing. All of it.
They realize
this is an investment worth returning it, like it was studied. So I can't complain at all. They're being excellent. Yeah.
What is your shipping restrictions?
If you really look at the nationwide now, I think there are only four or five states left that do not allow.
Yes.
Some of them, unfortunately, are very complicated, or they have fees that makes no sense. So we chose not to ship in those either. And so legally, meaning we pay the fees and whatever registration, we're shipping in about 19. I think it's 18 or 19 right now. Florida being one, for example.
Yeah, Florida's pretty easy about getting stuff in here. Just about everybody ships to us. That's
well,
good.
It's pretty easy. The only thing is difficult for us that you have different taxes by county, excise tax. So
right.
We have to keep track of all that. But and return money to different counties different way, which we do. I'm glad there are great softwares now that you can purchase and to keep track of all your taxes on all the states. That's going to help a lot to promote wine. Wine in general in America, it's the shipping to consumers. It's a great thing. And a great right that we should have.
And it's improving all the time, which is even better. So
Yes.
So unless there's any other comments you want to make, I want to thank you so very much for taking your time tonight.
All I can say is that I'm glad that I end up coming to the United States as a winemaker and help develop a wine region with other people like me that have the passion and interest to do it. I just love what I do and I love to share with others.
and it shows too, and it shows in your passion as you're talking with me and in your excitement and and your knowledge. So it's fantastic. So again, I remind you, contact other wineries
yes.
that you know of there and have them get in touch with me through the email, through the
Absolutely.
All About Wine email, and I would like to get them scheduled. Also, if you would like to let our listeners know all your contact information, your address, your email, your Facebook, your Twitter, your phone number, everything. So if anybody would like to get in touch with you, they will have all the information.
Yeah, the best, it is our website. It's bbvwine.com, bobvictorwine.com. And it has a lot of great information about buying wine from us, about the restaurant, about the inn, and all other details. Our address, we are in 17655 Winery Road in Barboursville, Virginia. And the main phone number, 540-832-3824.
And your hours are 7 days a week?
We're open 7 days a week in the visitor center, just about 10 to 5 every day and 11 to 5 on Sunday. And the restaurant has a little different hours, and the inn is open every day.
Does the restaurant need reservations usually?
The weekends, definitely. During the week, sometime is better also. It's only 50 seats.
Oh, okay. All right, very good. It has been a pleasure and a joy, Luke. I've really enjoyed spending this time with you. And I have some relatives that live up in Maryland, not too far from there. Next time I go visit them, I will borrow one of their cars
Please.
And come down and visit you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I would really look forward to that. So,
yes.
And by the way, the website is gorgeous. Any of you out there listening,
you.
Check
Thanks.
Out the website because there's a lot of information on there.
Yeah.
So it's been great. Thank you, Luca. It's been
You're
a
welcome.
Joy and a pleasure. And we'll look forward to possibly meeting you in person someday.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. All right. Oh, here. See, Mike was so good about getting, let's see, where is it? No, I don't want the cheers. I want the claps. Where is it? There we go. Okay. Yeah, Mike usually gets that right away, but I had to look for it. Well, great. I was looking for that interview on, and it did not disappoint. It lived up to my expectations. It was very interesting. A lot of good stuff there. A lot of stuff about Virginia and Barboursville Vineyards. Check out the website. I'm serious, all of you out there. It is a gorgeous website with lots of information on there. We already talked about the fact that we have a class this coming Sunday. I played that little blurb for you before we brought Luca in. We also have a wine fest coming up Saturday. So it's going to be a busy weekend for us. So here, let me play this for you here.
Coming up this Saturday at Florida Estates Winery, it's Wine Fest, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Enjoy live music, have a little fun, and shop our vendors providing unique handmade items and some brand names you have known for years. Participate in an informative wine tasting with wine expert and show host, Ron. Sample some of Florida Estates Winery's world-class wines. Shopping is always fun, and Wine Fest is a great way to pick up unique gift items. Come out to Florida Estates Winery and enjoy the weekend with us. Listen to live music and shop under the giant oak trees while enjoying a glass of your favorite wine. This is a family event, and pets are welcome at Florida Estates Winery. See you there. Florida Estates Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call 813-996-2113 or email corp@flune.com. That's corp@flewn.com for more information. Florida Estates Winery is open daily, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m.
This concludes
concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida States Winery. Florida States Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida, 4 miles west of Interstate 75 or east of US 19 and US 41. For more information on Florida States Winery, visit the website at floridaestateswines.com or call area code 813-996-2113. The email address is corp@flune.com. That's corp@flewn.com. For more information on All About Wine and future shows, please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr or visit our website at allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available as a free download on iTunes and on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on All About Wine.